The next case on calendar this morning is Nevada Department of Corrections versus 8th Judicial District. Cases 74679 and 74722. Parties ready to begin?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Jordan Smith, Deputy Solicitor General, on behalf of the Department of Corrections.
Before you get into this and any references to time, does either party have a representation as to where Mr. Dozier stands at this point, what he wishes, because that's not been elaborated from the original, of whether he still wishes to die or whether he does not wish, or very succinctly?
Your Honor, my understanding is that Mr. Dozier still wishes to die. However, the last word that we have from him at the district court level, including up to today, is that he supports this litigation and that he seeks a humane execution.
Thank you. Counsel, please proceed.
I attempt to reserve about 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The district court's analysis and the constitutional standard advanced by the Federal Public Defender's Office in this case will result in a de facto ban on the death penalty in this state. The Constitution does not require the avoidance of all risk of pain during an execution, and the district court found that when the protocol is carried out as written, there is no risk, let alone a substantial risk of pain, awareness, or air hunger, because the first two drugs will render Mr. Dozier sufficiently unconscious such that he doesn't experience any discomfort from the third drug.
Mr. Smith, before you get into the merits, this case is troublesome to me because it seems to be infected by a serious procedural defect. We made clear in McConnell that issues litigating the appropriateness of the method of execution is to be conducted under a 1983 case. Issues amounting to cruel and unusual punishment may not be raised in post-conviction habeas proceedings. In this case, my understanding of the record is the Federal Public Defender's Office and counsel for Mr. Dozier suspended the state habeas proceedings. And then we get into this series of exchanges in the district court about the propriety of this execution protocol. And not once did anybody pursue the procedures outlined by this court in McConnell, requiring it to be done in 1983, where you have an actual litigation and a bench trial. Now, I'd like your comment about that, because what I'm concerned about is that in the briefs it seems to suggest that the Department of Corrections says, well, we waive this, or Dozier waived this, or everybody's fine with this. But that's not what we said in McConnell, and there were very sound reasons for it, underscored, by the way, in the Bucklew certiorari that's just been accepted, which itself was a 1983 review of a execution protocol. Could you please address this procedurally? I think fundamentally this is a serious problem in our review of what transpired here.
Sure. There's a couple things in there, and I'll address them. First of all, I read McConnell differently than Your Honor. This court in McConnell said it's not, method of execution challenges are not cognizable in the habeas action. They should be brought in 1983, relying upon the Supreme Court's case in Hill. This court also uses the same phrasing of not cognizable in, for example, 12b-5 motions to dismiss. Not cognizable does not connote necessarily without jurisdiction. That's the point that the federal courts make in cases interpreting Hill and Nelson, for example, Adams versus Bradshaw, Duty versus Workman. Those courts point out that the United States Supreme Court has never said that the courts are without jurisdiction to hear them in habeas proceedings. Hill said it may be brought in habeas. Nelson said it's appropriate to bring them, or excuse me, Hill said they may be brought in 1983. Nelson said it's appropriate to bring them in 1983. No court has said it must be brought in 1983. And from a state's perspective, I don't mean to cut you off, but from a state's perspective, if actions must be brought under 1983, it's unclear to me how a challenge under the state constitution, say there was a straight challenge just under the state constitution, 1983 deals with violations of federal constitutional rights. So if the action is brought under the state constitution, 1983 isn't an appropriate mechanism to bring that challenge. Additionally, if you required a condemned inmate to run to a different district in the 8th Judicial District, you'd have the odd circumstance of one 8th JD judge issuing an injunction to stop a valid execution warrant for another 8th JD judge. So no court has said that it's a jurisdictional requirement. Glossop has a summary of what Hill said, and Glossop describes Hill itself as a case about civil procedure. Rules of civil procedure, as the U.S. Supreme Court says in Kontrick, are claim processing rules, not jurisdictional rules. Jurisdiction only extends to things like personal jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, the court's power to actually hear a case. The court's ruling in McConnell was not a jurisdictional ruling. And conversely, the state below agreed to allow Mr. Dozier's motion to determine lawfulness to be treated as if it were properly a 1983 complaint. That's at 538D, 538B, and some other references in the record. So,
what's the standard of review here?
Well, if the court is assessing whether it has jurisdiction, that's a de novo standard of review. That'd be a de novo standard of review. And again, McConnell didn't say it. Hill didn't say it. That these types of
McConnell, the way you suggested, what's the standard of review here?
Jurisdictional questions are reviewed de novo.
No, you said it's not jurisdictional. If we reviewed this case the way you advocate, what's the standard of review?
So going to the merits, the standard of review here is also de novo because the court is interpreting what is the meaning of cruel and what is the meaning of unusual under the federal and state constitutions. So the standard of review here is de novo. Does cruel mean, as the district court found, that it's cruel anytime there's a possibility of mistake? Does it mean, as the United States Supreme Court held in Bays and Glossop, that there has to be a substantial risk that is sure, very likely, or imminent? Those are legal questions, and the standard of review here is de novo.
Counsel, can I ask you just follow up on Justice Hardesty's question? I'm not sure I heard the answer. He indicated that perhaps you waived any defect in this not being brought as a 1983 action. Is that correct?
That's one way to look at it.
Okay, and then you said perhaps you can bring this as a habeas action. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, let me ask you this. Considering the fact that the habeas petition was stayed down below, how are you here? It's stayed. The federal public defender came in to associate to an action that is stayed.
That would go to my second point, that the parties agreed, the Department of Corrections agreed that the motion to determine lawfulness could be construed as a 1983 complaint. The court has jurisdiction to hear 1983 actions, and so to the extent that when the department came into this action, the status of the habeas proceeding was unclear.
Well, the state. Well, no. When the department came in, I'm sorry.
Yeah, when the department came in, the status was unclear. The department's not a party to whatever agreement exists between between Mr. Dozier and his counsel and the district attorney's office. And respectfully, sort of the parameters of that agreement has shifted throughout the process of this. Dozier, at one of his last appearances, he said, as far as he's concerned, he doesn't have a habeas proceeding. So the status of that is a little bit unclear.
Okay, and you're pointing, I think I understand this correctly, you're pointing the fact that the district court has inherent authority to turn this into a 1983 action.
Not necessarily to turn this into a 1983 action.
Okay, so what was the aspect of the court's inherent authority if it wasn't in addressing the 1983 issue?
The argument that's been made by the Federal Public Defender's Office is that the Department of Corrections actually agrees with this.
Okay.
The district court has inherent authority to determine the lawfulness of its own orders, to determine whether an order she entered, in this case, the execution warrant, is lawful. The department agrees with that statement, provided she has to work within the parameters of governing case law. The courts have inherent authority to determine the lawfulness of their own orders. So, I mean, as far as habeas goes, I understand habeas also is limited to scenarios that challenge the validity of the conviction itself. That's been construed in some cases as challenging the validity of the death sentence. Capital punishment generally. Respectfully, the arguments that are being made here are essentially an attack on the death penalty itself. The standard adopted by the district court is that mistakes, the mere possibility of a mistake is enough to enjoin any method of execution. That essentially falls into question lethal injection, capital punishment generally. And so those types of claims are also permissible in habeas proceedings if it's an attack on the sentence or the punishment. And here the arguments being made are essentially an attack on lethal injection itself.
Well, this all started out as simply a motion to determine what the protocol was, isn't it? And then it just kind of morphed into this
bigger issue.
There
were arguments at one point, the Federal Public Defender's Office was trying to essentially turn this into a public records request action too. I mean, the shape of this, much to the chagrin of the department, has morphed. Eventually, we got to an evidentiary hearing. The evidence established that when the protocol is carried out as written, there is no risk of pain, no substantial risk of pain. There's a risk if and only if there's an unforeseen error in the administration of the protocol. That is the same risk of error that's inherent in every human activity. That's why the United States Supreme Court rejected that standard, unnecessary risk standard in Bayes. This court rejected that standard way back in 1923 in Gijon, when this court held that the risk of a bungle is no argument against the method of execution. And so first I'll address the governing Supreme Court.
Well, I have questions. You ready, Mr. Smith?
I'm ready.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to congratulate our chief for allowing 80 minutes of argument in this case. I've been on the court for 12 years. I've never had that amount of time, and I congratulate Chief Justice Douglas for allowing this. I think the public needs to know on this case. We need to get all the facts out. 12 people have been put to death in Nevada since 1976. What was the combination of drugs that were used in these executions for the 12 since 1976?
For all 12, I couldn't tell you all 12. I know the last one, 2006, involved sodium thiopental, provolone, which is a paralytic, which is in the bromide family, and then potassium chloride. And then there was a shift in the state's lethal injection protocol to just using midazolam and hydromorphone, but no execution was actually carried out under that protocol.
Why was the shift?
Why was there a shift? Because all states, which has been documented, have difficulty obtaining the drugs in the classic three drug cocktail, like when Daryl Mack was executed in 2006.
So you're not familiar with whatever occurred for the 11 others who were put to death by the state?
I'm not, Your Honor. It's not in this record either.
Okay. Now, all the states are having the same difficulty. What are the other states using as far as protocol? What drugs are they using as opposed to what we're using?
Some drugs are able to still use the three-drug protocol. Other states have shifted to a one-drug barbiturate protocol. Nebraska, for example, it's been reported in the press, is actually adopting a protocol very similar to the one we're using with cisatricurium, although I believe if the press reports are accurate, they've got potassium chloride.
You're talking very fast, and I want to make sure that the public understands exactly what the protocol would be with Mr. Dozier. What drugs would be used, and what are the expectations of using these drugs as far as a glitch in the execution?
Okay, certainly, I can walk through how the protocol works.
Please do.
Okay.
Slowly.
Okay.
So I can hear you and understand. Thank you.
Come
That's why we've given the Chief Justice has given everybody plenty of time in this case.
I hope the 40 minutes is enough. Okay, so the way under the protocol, EM 110, section 0.2 in the execution protocol, lays out how the actual proceeding will go. It begins with 50 milligrams of diazepam delivered over 1 minute. Then there's a 1 minute wait period before conducting a verbal consciousness check. Asking, hey, Mr. Dozier, can you hear me? If you can hear me, raise your thumb. An interpretable response to verbal stimulus. The absence of that indicates that he's in a high level of sedation from the diazepam. If he responds to verbal stimulus, meaning he's still conscious after the diazepam, there's a supplemental dosing of 25 milligrams delivered over another minute. They wait a minute, then you go through the same verbal consciousness check again. If he still responds to that after what is now 75 milligrams, there's yet one more dosing of 25 milligrams of diazepam with another verbal consciousness check. At that point, there are five options that are available based upon the recommendation of the attending physician who is in the execution chamber throughout the entirety of the proceeding, literally inches away from Mr. Dozier, along with the warden. Both the warden and attending physician are in the execution chamber the entire time, monitoring levels of consciousness and monitoring the patency of the IVs, that they're free-flowing and there's no issues with the delivery of the drugs. Once Mr. Dozier stops responding to verbal stimulus, then they move on to the second drug, fentanyl. It starts with a delivery of 5,000 micrograms of fentanyl, which is referred to as a bolus dose, which is a large dose, delivered over 2 minutes. Then you wait 90 seconds, you do a tactile stimulus check, tactile consciousness check. Those are the same consciousness checks the U.S. Supreme Court said in Bayes are not even constitutionally required. Justice Ginsburg, in her dissent in Bayes, said that Kentucky should adopt these types of tactile stimulus checks. She pointed to Alabama, which does verbal consciousness checks, and the actual pinch that we're using in this case. So that's what the tactile stimulus consciousness check is here after the 5,000 micrograms of fentanyl. It's a pinch to see if there's a response to that. The FDA fentanyl insert, which we introduced into evidence at the evidentiary hearing, also says before introducing a paralytic to stop involuntary movements that can happen during fentanyl-induced anesthesia is to check with a tactile stimulus as light as an eyelash reflex. So the state's tactile stimulus consciousness check here is much more invasive than this eyelash reflex that the FDA recommends. If Mr. Dozier responds to tactile stimulus, meaning still indicating consciousness, then a second dosage of the fentanyl, 2,500 micrograms, will be delivered. After the first 5,000 micrograms, it will be delivered. Wait 90 seconds and do another round of the tactile consciousness check, the pinch. At that point, if he doesn't respond to verbal stimulus or to tactile stimulus, that's when the Department of the Drug Administrators will be signaled by the attending physician. It's important to emphasize the paralytic, the cisatricurium, the third and final drug, will not be delivered at all unless the attending physician determines after the tactile stimulus pinch that he's unconscious, and then the attending physician signals to the drug administrators that it's safe to deliver the third drug. As the protocol is written, there will not be the delivery of the third paralytic drug unless and until Mr. Dozier passes a tactile stimulus check and the attending physician tells the drug administrators to proceed. At that point, 100 milligrams of the cisatricurium will be delivered over 1 minute. Wait 5 minutes, and then another 100 milligrams of the cisatricurium will be delivered, and then the cardiac monitor turned on to determine any signs of consciousness or life at that point.
What's the time frame if only two drugs are used, as opposed to if three drugs are used, till death?
The only testimony presented at the evidentiary hearing on that point came from Dr. Wiesel. That's at 841 and 842 of the record. My colleague at the Federal Public Defender's Office asked him, under a two-drug cocktail, how long will it take for Mr. Dozier to expire. Dr. Wiesel testified that at some point after the administration of 7,500 micrograms of fentanyl, so the full dosage, both dosages, not just the loading dosages of the fentanyl, and then 100 milligrams of diazepam, so the initial plus all the supplemental ones of diazepam dosages, that based upon those dosages, at some point, Mr. Dozier, in his opinion, will stop breathing, and then a 10-minute clock will start. That's what Dr. Wiesel testified, 10 minutes. But when my colleague asked him, okay, how long will it take to administer 7,500, the maximum, not the maximum, but the highest planned for doses, and the 100 milligrams of diazepam, the highest planned for doses of diazepam, how long will that take before the 10-minute clock will start? And Dr. Wiesel couldn't answer that. So let's compare that timing from how the protocol's timing will go. Remember, Dr. Wiesel testified that if everything is delivered as written and there's no unforeseen error or mistake, the loading doses themselves, so the 50 milligrams of diazepam and the first 5,000 micrograms of fentanyl, if they're all delivered and there's no unforeseen error, those will be enough to render him unconscious before the cisatricurium is introduced. So based upon the timeline using just the loading dosages, we're talking about a process that will last about 12 and a half to 13 minutes, which is faster than Dr. Wiesel was contemplating. Again, he's contemplating 7,500 micrograms of fentanyl. He didn't say rate of administration. He didn't say, didn't give us any rates of dosages at all. So he was just presumably working off the timeline already in the protocol. So it will take at least 4 minutes of fentanyl alone to deliver the first 5,000 micrograms and then the second 2,500 micrograms. So at least on fentanyl alone, you're looking at 10 minutes plus four, you're already looking at 14, whereas the states on the loading doses, you're looking at about 12 and a half to 13 minutes. As the U.S. Supreme Court pointed out in Bays, one of the permissible purposes of a paralytic is to hasten death, and that's certainly the case here based upon the state's protocol and Dr. Wiesel's testimony.
How different is the Dozier protocol from the MAC protocol? How different is it?
The MAC protocol was not introduced into evidence, and I have a general idea, but I'm not comfortable making any representations about that.
I appreciate your answers.
Mr. Smith. Can I just ask, because I know this has a lot of public interest in this case, and some of these medical terms are not commonly known, but they have general public. Now, is diazepam, is that a Valium-type drug, or what is that? What's the common name for that?
It's in the class of drugs, benzodiazepine.
Yeah.
It's an anxiolytic, another fancy term, which just means anxiety-reducing. It has some sedative effects and a muscle relaxant, according to Dr. DeMiro's declaration.
Okay, now fentanyl, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is kind of a supercharged heroin. It's an opiate, is only it's a much heavier impact, and it's abused a lot by drug addicts and all like that. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and then the cyproculium, excuse me if I mispronounce it, but that's a muscle relaxer. It's used in surgeries and things like that. That's the general medical use.
Technical term is a neuromuscular blocking agent. It's a paralytic. It's commonly used in hospitals, most often for intubation. It's safely used, as Dr. Wiesel testified, on infants and children. It's commonly used, provided that the patient or the inmate, depending on the context, is sufficiently unconscious when it is introduced. The fentanyl insert sort of explains the process of that. Fentanyl-induced anesthesia can cause involuntary muscle movements. The insert itself says some of the movements can even cause patient management problems. So once you check for consciousness after an eyelash reflex test, basically rubbing the eyelashes to see if there's any sort of response, then it is safe to introduce a neuromuscular blocking agent, a paralytic, to stop those involuntary movements.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Smith, in previous pleadings in this proceeding in this court, representations were made that the some or all of the drugs that you're talking about using have expired or will expire. Could you state the current status of that and as to each drug?
Yeah, so diazepam, if I may continue and trespass on some of my colleagues' time, diazepam, the first drug in the protocol and the first drug in the Federal Public Defender's legal team's alternative, the entire supply expired completely on May 1. On, I believe it was April 1, one batch, if my memory serves, one batch of the paralytic expired, but there are reserve supplies of the paralytic, and the expiration date for the paralytic, the third drug, isn't presently an issue. It's, I forget when the exact cutoff is, but it's a ways out.
So given the fact that the first drug has expired, does that make this matter moot at the moment?
No, and let me, a couple reasons why. The district court's concern was that there could be an error in the delivery of the first drug, first two drugs, leading to a masking event with the paralytic. That concern will always be present anytime there's a paralytic in the state's protocol. So even if there's a substitute drug for the diazepam, the district court could always hypothesize that there could be an error in the administration of those drugs leading to a masking event with the paralytic. So keeping the paralytic in the protocol, as the department intends to do, renders this capable of repetition yet evading review. Again, as Your Honor pointed out, we're dealing with expiration dates on drugs. These cases are complicated. They take a long time. Generally speaking, inmates' lawyers fight as hard as they can to push the litigation out past the drug expiration dates. And so getting the issue before the court, whether a mistake, which this court dealt with in Gijon, teeing up the issue before this court about whether a mistake is enough to enjoin a protocol is capable of repetition yet evading review as long as the paralytic is in the protocol. But even more broadly, the district court's reasoning calls into question every future method of execution as well. There will always be the chance of human error, no matter how many safeguards are in place. And as this court said in Gijon, the chance that a hanging, firing squad, gas chamber, the fact that there might be a bungle is no argument against it. This court said it presumes that state officials tasked with carrying out capital punishment will do so in a way to avoid inflicting cruel punishments. The federal court.
So a couple of points, Mr. Smith. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but
okay.
The first point is that as it relates to Mr. Dozier, the first drug that would be used in this three-drug cocktail is no longer available to the state because it has expired.
I would modify that slightly. The state's current supply is expired. It doesn't have any diazepam in its current possession. It's possible that the state finds an alternate supplier, in which case it would go forward with this cocktail if it finds an alternative supply. It's currently not been able to do that, but if it was able to do so, it would go forward with this protocol if it were able to find an alternate supply for it.
And so the second point, principally, the state is asking us to rule on this issue because of the district court's addressing the third drug.
That's correct, which has not expired.
And you don't consider that to be an advisory opinion.
No, Your Honor, because the reason the district court is concerned about the third drug is premised upon an error in the delivery of the first two drugs. The exact drugs that she's hypothesizing about an error, it's not unique to diazepam. We could find a substitute drug, and Dr. Wiesel could testify the same thing, that a substitute drug will render him sufficiently unconscious, But the district court was concerned that there could be an error which would lead to a masking event, and that will always be the case because we can always think of crazy hypotheticals where errors will happen leading to a masking event.
I have one additional question. Dr. Wiesel testified. The state had an expert that presented testimony, I guess, by way of declaration. But the state was afforded an opportunity by the district court judge to call that witness or other witnesses, I guess, live. Why didn't the state do that?
That's not accurate, Your Honor. The state wasn't afforded an opportunity to do so. If you look at the record, that hearing was set on two business days' notice.
Right.
The district court made comments of the record. I'll point you to them. At 9:39 of the record, the district court acknowledges she didn't invite testimony from an NDOC witness. She also acknowledged at 1257 TTT that the hearing was limited. It was set on 2 days' notice, and she said at 9:37 that it was a hearing limited to one witness.
So this is why I was concerned about the procedural aspect of this case. I'm very concerned that the development of the record here by experts, by testimony, would have occurred had this been a 1983 action as opposed to some amorphous, ambiguous habeas proceeding, to which, if it had been a habeas proceeding, I'm not even sure the department would have been a party to.
I disagree, Your Honor. From the department's standpoint, the department is happy with the record that was developed. Dr. Wiesel's testimony, who presumably would have been their witness at any evidentiary hearing, whether it was 1983 or not, his testimony is a testimony that demonstrates that this is a humane, safe protocol, barring some unforeseen error or mistake. So from the state's perspective, there's no witness we would have preferred to call. There's no other evidence we would have preferred to introduce. Based upon Dr. Wiesel's testimony alone, the state's comfortable that this protocol passes constitutional muster just based upon the evidence presented already at the evidentiary hearing.
Counsel, touching on Justice Hardesty's question, you indicated that if the diazepam isn't available, you can substitute another drug, correct?
That's correct.
And does that...
Assuming we can find an adequate substitute, yes.
Okay, and so can you tell me a little bit about just how stringent the protocol is? Why isn't it... does every state that does lethal injection require a paralytic?
It depends on the drugs. Not every state requires a paralytic. No, that's correct. I mean, some drugs, like I mentioned, do a one-drug barbiturate. The standard three-drug protocol, which was reviewed 3 years ago, almost 2 years ago, and Glossop included a paralytic. The Supreme Court has been denying certain cases routinely this year and the end of last year in states that have a paralytic in their protocol. Executions have happened this year with protocols that have paralytics in them. Even in the federal public defender's brief, they acknowledge that the same number of states use a paralytic as use their one-drug barbiturate protocol that they suggest for the first time on appeal. Now, I do want to make one point about the one-drug barbiturate. That argument was made for the first time on appeal. There was no evidence presented at the evidentiary hearing about a one-drug barbiturate.
Right.
They don't even disclose the name of the one-drug barbiturate that the state should use. From their standpoint, it makes sense why they pivoted to a one-drug protocol, because the two-drug protocol that the defense team offered isn't known within the meaning of Bayes and Glossop, because it's never been used before. One-drug protocols have been used before, but the burden is on the petitioner to demonstrate that a state can actually obtain and access the drugs in your alternative. That's the available and feasible prong. In cases like Arthur out of the 11th Circuit, McGahee versus Hutchinson out of the 8th Circuit say, the state has to be able to obtain the drug and obtain them for execution purposes. Simply because other states have access to other drugs does not mean that the state of Nevada can access the same drugs and obtain them for execution purposes.
So again, going forward with the diazepam or a substitute and the fentanyl would violate your protocol without the circum.
Sesatricurin, yes.
Whatever it's called.
The state's protocol is limited right now to diazepam, fentanyl, and sesatricurin.
Okay.
The alternative offered by the defense team and apparently ordered by the district court, it's not been written down. There's no written protocol for that. The Federal Public Defender's Office is worried about training and qualifications, but there's been no training, done on this two-drug protocol. It's never been written down. It couldn't possibly be trained. But the three-drug protocol, by contrast, there has been training that's outlined in the protocol itself. The protocol demonstrates, and the district court recognized this at paragraph 29 of her order, The protocol specifies the qualifications for the execution team members, the training that must occur beforehand. Any deviation from the qualifications set forth in the protocol or the training set forth in the protocol would just be another type of speculative error. The Constitution simply does not require that execution team members have a certain curriculum vitae or a resume. Taylor versus Crawford says physicians aren't even required to participate. Anesthesiologists aren't even required to participate, but yet here we have an attending physician who will be there. We had an anesthesiologist, Dr. DeMiro, who helped craft the protocol. So we've gone above and beyond constitutional standards. On the training issue, the Ninth Circuit's decision in Towery versus Brewer and Beatty versus Brewer all say that the Constitution doesn't dictate a certain training regimen. The Constitution doesn't say 10 practice runs are enough, one practice run isn't, a five-hour training session is fine, but a 30-minute training session isn't. Those are all speculative errors. Likewise, the federal public defender's concern about the drugs being contaminated, again, that's an argument presented for the first time at the hearing, or on appeal. The hearing didn't address that. There's one point not made in the briefs that should be pointed out to your honors. Zink versus Lombardi, a case that we did cite repeatedly for other propositions, also point out that there's no private right of action under the federal drug statutes highlighted by the federal public defender's office. Additionally, the Supreme Court in Brewer versus Landrigan pointed out that concerns about lethal injection drugs being from illicit sources or being contaminated are speculative unless there's evidence. Speculative concerns are by definition not sure, very likely, or imminent, as is required by Bayes and Glossop.
Counsel, you touched on it a little bit, but tell us why this falls under substantial risk, number one. And number two, there's the issue as to whether or not our state is mandated to adopt an alternate protocol, as it's been suggested, on behalf of our defendant.
Sure, I'll take them in that order. There is no substantial risk here. Dr. Wiesel testified to that again. When the protocol is carried out as written, on the loading doses themselves, meaning the initial dosages of diazepam, the initial dosages of fentanyl, Mr. Dozier is not at risk of awareness, air hunger, pain, panic. That's block quoted extensively at pages 18 and through 20 of our RIP petition. So there is no substantial risk here. The risk present at all is if there's an unforeseen error, which the Supreme Court said in Bayes is not objectively intolerable. It's what this court said in Gijon, that the fact that there could be a bungle does not mean that the method of execution is unconstitutional. We presume that officials will do their best to carry it out. That's the presumption from Gijon. Federal courts in Wellens have adopted the same thing. To your second point about whether the state should adopt the requirement of an alternative, this court has said in opinions, I'm thinking of the Osborne decision, that generally speaking, this court defers to federal interpretations of similar provisions. And I understand our Constitution says cruel or unusual instead of cruel and unusual. But this court will defer to federal interpretations of analogous provisions unless there are strong policy reasons to deviate. And there are no strong policy reasons to deviate here, especially to adopt the unnecessary risk test that the federal public defender proffers. They don't sketch out the parameters of the unnecessary risk test, but in order for them to prevail, this court would have to say that an unnecessary risk prevents even the chance that there might be an error. That would, again, halt every possible method of execution. There's always the risk of an error. And so an unnecessary risk test defined in a way for Mr. Dozier to win would require the prohibition on any possibility of mistake.
Hasn't the U.S. Supreme Court not adopted that secondary test that they're putting forth?
That's right. The Supreme Court specifically rejected that in Bayes. The dissent offered the unnecessary risk test or untoward risk in Bayes, and the Supreme Court specifically rejected the unnecessary risk test under the federal Constitution. My colleagues at the Federal Public Defender's Office want this court to adopt the unnecessary risk test, and they say this court can do that, and they hang their hat on one word in the state constitution, the or. And I find it more than a little bit ironic that they want this court to give the plain meaning to the word or, but not give the plain meaning to the word cruel, and then not give the plain meaning to the word unusual. At the time of enactment, as this court said in Thomas versus Nevada Yellow Cab in 2014, this court interprets the state constitution under the original public understanding. And the original public understanding of the phrase cruel and unusual, or cruel or unusual, was designed specifically to just prohibit methods of execution deliberately designed to inflict pain above and beyond that required to make a condemned person pass away. Unusual meant no longer regularly or customarily employed. Unusual didn't mean, as they try and define it now, has never been used before. This court in Gijon rejected that interpretation of unusual, because if the federal public defender is right about what unusual means, Gijon should have come out the other way. Gijon was the first court in the country to approve the use of the gas chamber. If unusual meant never before used, this court should have not let the gas chamber go forward, because we were the first state to do that in our quest to find more humane methods of execution. And Gijon said specifically, rejected that line of reasoning, saying that means scientific progress would halt in the face of longstanding usage, and that we're limited to methods that are, quote, now in vogue. Gijon said that's not the case. So new methods are, of execution are not prohibited in this state simply because they're unusual. That would effectively outsource this state's ability to find humane methods of execution to other states, which is not what, what the court said in Gijon, the framers of this state intended. And unless the court has any questions. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Van Bostrick, and I represent the petitioner Clark County DA's office. Initially, I'd like to thank the court for giving each petitioner 20 minutes. I appreciate the court granting my motion. Just to correct the record on a point that was brought up before, the stipulation between the parties was entered into before either the Attorney General or the Federal Public Defender entered the case. Both myself and Mr. Erickson were present for that. If I misrecall, I'm sure they'll correct me. When the state, the district attorney, brought McConnell to the attention of the lower court, without discussion, without analysis, we were told, feel free to take up a writ. When we brought the federal public defender's decision to abandon Mr. Dozier in favor of other clients to the attention of the lower court, we're told, quote, ask the Supreme Court, take the writ up, take it all up, all of it, go. That's at 5 Petitioner's Appendix 1027. Writ relief is warranted here because the lower court ignored McConnell and it ignored the FPD's decision to abandon Mr. Dozier. McConnell is crystal clear. The manner of execution is beyond the scope of Chapter 34. According to McConnell, if you want to challenge the manner of execution, you need to file a separate and independent action, such as a 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 claim. The district attorney brought McConnell to the attention of the lower court in 2 separate pleadings, and we raised it verbally at 2 separate hearings, all to no avail. Every time we're told, feel free to take a writ up. Now, the federal...
Well, you've got to admit this was a bit of an unusual circumstance, which the judge identified. Here you've got a writ petition on the underlying criminal proceeding that's been stayed, and you have the federal public defender coming in as co-counsel with an inmate who doesn't want to contest the death sentence, and all they want to do is file a motion to determine what the protocol is. I mean, I've never seen it, and the district court judge said the same thing.
Yeah, and I'm not casting stones at her.
Oh, I know. I understand.
But my point is, when she's told the law, when she's given your law, she either needs to apply it or she needs to make a record explaining why she believes it doesn't apply so this court can judge whether she's wrong or right.
Well, and I had mentioned earlier this argument about the court's inherent authority. Tell me about that.
My concern with the court's alleged inherent authority is that the federal public defender premises that upon the idea that since Judge Togliatti signed the warrant of execution, she has this inherent authority to make sure that the protocol is constitutional. There's 2 difficulties with that. First, Judge Togliatti, when she signed that warrant, was not exercising judicial discretion. It was a purely ministerial function. The statute required her to sign the order because the jury had exercised its discretion, and even the date of the execution was governed by the statute. She had no decision-making authority whatsoever. But more importantly, in Halverson, this court specifically said that inherent authority, the use of it, is limited to circumstances where established methods fail or there's an emergency. No one has ever contended there was an emergency here.
Let me ask you this, then, in that regard, and I agree with what you just said, but then there was this added little added little thing where they wanted to determine what the protocol was. Does that constitute an emergency?
No,
the only reason they came in.
It's outside McConnell. There's no emergency. They had the opportunity, and we brought to the PD's, the FPD's attention and the lower court's attention. The established method under McConnell was file a separate and independent action. 42 U.S.C. 1983 action.
But it sounds to me like there was some type of an agreement to go ahead and contest this thing, and that did that constitute a waiver of any kind?
And that goes to my concerns with the AG's point. Assuming that inherent authority could stretch that far, that we could magically transmute a 34 into a 1983 without properly filing a separate action, the AG has no authority to enter into such a stipulation. Under NRS 34.730 sub 2 and NRS 34.745 sub 2, their role in habeas is limited to petitions that challenge the computation of credit for time served.
They're all saying that it was converted by the court's inherent authority to a 1983 action.
And my point is they don't have that authority. Judge Togliatti did not have that authority. This court in Halverson said that inherent authority, it has to be an emergency, or established methods have to fail. McConnell is the established method. File that separate independent action. They refused to do that, and the lower court didn't require them to do it. The established methods could not have failed because they were never tried.
But they are arguing also that they have a different interpretation of the state constitution than the federal constitution because of cruel or unusual rather than cruel and unusual, and therefore it would not classically be a 1983 action. That's my first point. My second point is, and I apologize for taking him over time, we have the DEC relief statutes in Nevada. NRS 30.070 seems to say you can get declaratory judgment in the context of another suit. I'm not sure whether that flies or not, but could you comment on both those points? I'm not sure 1983 would have given them the full vehicle that they wanted, and secondly, can they stipulate in an NRS 34 action to NRS 30 relief?
Okay. Under McConnell, I don't believe we can stipulate, because McConnell says it's outside the scope. In Habistro, this court said that we cannot, as a party, agree to waive the requirements of Chapter 34. McConnell was a straight interpretation of the plain text of Chapter 34 that concluded that the manner of execution, the protocol, is outside the scope. So none of us can, in fact, stipulate to that. But again, if anyone could, only the DA could, because habeas, everything except for computation of time served, is given to the district attorney by statute. We never stipulate. The other issue, declaratory relief, the FPD raised that in their pleading. The difficulty with that is that declaratory relief has some very specific requirements, including adversity between the parties, a real controversy, and ripeness. Here there were none of those. Mr. Dozier was accepting of a protocol that used increased fentanyl but included a paralytic. He said that on the record. The Department of Corrections was willing to execute him using that protocol. The only one who disagreed was the federal public defender. As to transmuting the habeas petition into declaratory relief, the district court made no findings. Yeah. The findings of fact are silent as to declaratory relief. They don't address the requirements for declaratory relief. And fell back on inherent authority, perhaps because they realized declaratory relief was not appropriate.
Mr. Van Boskirk, could you comment on Mr. Smith's observation that I know he disagrees with the reading I suggested from McConnell, evidently disagreeing with both of us on this point. But the question I had is, did McConnell make these challenges jurisdictional?
I believe it did. Because it read Chapter 34 to say the protocol is outside the scope of Chapter 34. Mm-hmm. Outside the scope is purely jurisdictional. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, from my read, what McConnell says. It says that the habeas does not include the manner of execution because that doesn't deal with computation of time served, a challenge to the judgment, or a challenge to the sentence. That's why this court said you can't use that vehicle.
And you've made this point before, but I want to be clear about it. To the extent that the federal public defender may have stipulated to the development of this record, and the attorney general's office did, Clark County DA's office never did.
No, we never did. We repeatedly objected.
And you are a party to this case.
I am a party, and in fact, I would argue that under the habeas statute, where Mr. Dozier filed a habeas petition under Chapter 34, the state is the DA is the only party to the state here in terms of that pleading, that the AG has no authority to agree to anything in the context of that because the statute does not give them control over that. They are only given computation of credit for time served.
This issue, Mr. Smith argues that we should review this de novo. Pragmatically, what would be the problem in the court entertaining the merits given the DA's objection to this procedure?
Well, that's one of my concerns. If this had gone the 1983 route like you suggest, both parties would have the right to appeal. The standard of review, we might bicker about it, but I would suggest that it was de novo because it's primarily an issue of law. If we keep it in habeas, pursuant to NRS 34.575 sub 2, the state has no right to appeal unless the lower court discharges a petitioner from custody or changes his custody status. The order here didn't do that. So here I am, hat in hand, begging for extraordinary relief, that even if you believe me, this court could simply say, we don't want to hear the petition. And if you're willing to listen, my burden of persuasion on this type of relief is one of the highest under the law. I have to prove that the lower court used jurisdiction she didn't have or abused her discretion in a manifestly abusive, capricious, arbitrary manner. That's very different than a de novo review I would have on a 1983 appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the process matters.
So the reason I'm exploring these issues with you is the general's office has acknowledged that the one drug, the initial drug, has expired. So they're asking for us to rule on the merits of this issue in order for future executions to be approved under the protocol they've adopted. In your case, you're emphasizing your concerns here because of the precedent that entertaining this case would set and the impact on future issues like this where the DA's arguments on appeal could be impacted. Is that correct?
Yes. In fact, as a product of my, as a practical matter, every death penalty habeas petition from here on out will now have to, assuming you bless the process that the district court used, will have to involve the DA and the AG because they are invariably going to make the same type of claims against the protocol. So it has an immense impact on the entire system, is my point, when they had an adequate remedy they could have taken that was pointed out to them, which was the 1983 action. Did I answer your question?
Yes, sir.
Okay. With what little time I have left, I'd like to turn to the FPD's decision to abandon Mr. Dozier in favor of other clients. This matters because Mr. Dozier has the right to the effective assistance of counsel in this first habeas petition. Abandonment by counsel is ineffectiveness without a showing of prejudice. And in the federal system, it can waive the procedural bars. So it matters here. When the lower court enjoined the use of a paralytic, Mr. Dozier wrote to the judge saying, look, I don't want to deal with the delay associated with an appeal. Now that the fentanyl is at an appropriate level, I don't care about the paralytic. In response to this, the FPD put in writing, quote, even if this court permits Mr. Dozier's alleged waiver, it should still authorize the federal public defender to defend the court's judgment. The issues will undoubtedly have an effect on present and future clients of the FPD. According to them, They can abandon Mr. Dozier in the procedure that they rep, in the proceeding that they represent him for the benefit of other clients. Mr. Dozier.
Conflict?
Absolutely. And you can see in this case, Mr. Dozier said, I don't want the delay. I don't care about the paralytic. I just want the execution to go forward. He specifically said, I don't want the delay associated with appellate review. And where are we? And why are we? For the benefit of their other clients.
Is that the last word from Mr. Dozier on this proceeding?
Well, what? I don't get to talk to Mr. Dozier. So all
I
can do.
That, but on
the record. I'm not talking about off the record. That's the.
On the record, yes. In my take of record, I'll give you some quotes.
And what was the page reference for what you just read?
The FPD's quote is at 4 Petitioner's Appendix, my appendix, 947 to 48.
I meant Mr. Dozier. I'm sorry,
okay.
I was unclear.
Mr. Dozier had several comments. I'll read them to you and give you the page numbers.
Okay, thank you.
At the December 5th, 2017 hearing, Mr. Dozier said, quote, he's not concerned with a paralytic now that fentanyl is in a sufficient dosage. He also said, quote, my contention with my counsel has always been that with the fentanyl, I was okay with a paralytic. That's at 4 Petitioner's Appendix 969. At the same hearing, he also said, excuse me, quote, I had to make some agreements that I wasn't wholly in with so I could get reasonable representation. I was very concerned about not knowing the protocol until 7 days out. I was very concerned about only 500 micrograms or 100 micrograms of fentanyl. And in order to do that, I had to agree to things so I could get zealous representation that were not something I agree with 100%. That's at 4 Petitioner's Appendix 969 as well. So according to him, he's being strong-armed by the FPD.
Well, sir, to the court, didn't Mr. Dozier indicate that he wanted to be executed, this is on the, at the court, at this hearing, that he wanted to be executed regardless of how the judge ruled on the drugs, regardless of what she did, because he wanted to know if his death was going to be reasonably easy or if it was going to be a miserable one so he could game up. But he didn't say, I don't want to do it. He, in fact, told the judge, I want to go forward no matter what you rule. Is that correct?
Absolutely. In fact, when the judge ruled enjoining the paralytic and the AG said they want to take a writ up, he said, that's okay. I'll go with the paralytic. I don't want the delay. At an earlier proceeding, and I don't have the quote handy, unfortunately, he said something to the effect of that he would rather go have some pain during the death experience than deal with coming to court as often as he had to. His focus, clearly, whether you agree with him or not, is getting the death over with.
Didn't the judge waive his appearance at that same hearing, provided that he sent weekly letters saying that he still wanted to be executed?
Yes, he did. And in his words, he has been steadfast and resolute in his desire to be executed.
And so the net effect is that we are now here and one of the drugs to be used to execute him has expired.
And that directly impacts him and relates to the conflict, because that drug would not have expired had the FPD fought for the wishes of their client. And really, on that score, I know they've argued that, well, we could go against our client because he was under pressure. But that's directly belied by the record. At the November 8, 2017 hearing, Mr. Dozier said, quote, I don't feel I was under pressure. At the same hearing, when the FPD accused the AG of putting the warden up to pressuring Dozier into waiving habeas, Mr. Dozier said that he didn't want Mr. Anthony to feel he was being thrown under the bus, but his take on the warden's attitude was, quote, whatever I want to do with this, it's up to me, and he will follow up on his end and get it done. They've also argued incapacity, but that's belied by the competency evaluation that was initially done. And tellingly, despite saying he's incapacitated, despite saying he's under undue pressure, the FPD never asked for another evaluation. And yes, they will come to you and say, death is different, and that's why we should be allowed to do this.
And with that point, I'm going to cut you off. Our time has kind of got muddied because of the initial questions. But thank you. Mr. Anthony?
Mr. Anthony, before you get started, so I don't have to interrupt you, tell me what your view, you've heard my questions today, tell me what your view is of what we're considering. Is this a writ? Is this a morphed 1983 action? What is it?
Well, the proceeding before this court is an extraordinary writ proceeding.
No, I mean, I'm talking about the underlying proceeding, that you brought a motion to determine what the protocol was, and then at some point it morphed into something else because it became a challenge to the method, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so what was that?
What happened, Your Honor, and I think one thing to be very clear about is that what happened here is not connected to a habeas proceeding. This was not a claimant habeas petition. We filed a motion with the district court to determine the lawfulness of Mr. Dozier's execution in response to the court's legitimate questions that she had for the district attorney, where she was asking questions like, have you contacted the director? Does he know that this is going to happen? What drug combinations are you going to use? And in response, the district attorney said that we're not going to ask any of those questions, Judge, until you sign the warrant. And so what the federal public defender did when we associated as counsel is we filed a motion with the court asking the court to exercise its inherent authority to inquire into the lawfulness of its own orders. Here, the judge was being asked to sign an execution warrant when she didn't have any assurances about whether the execution was going to be able to go forward and whether it would be able to go forward in a lawful manner. At the time that the motion was filed, there was no signed and adopted protocol. Nobody knew what the drugs were, and nobody had any answers for the district court.
You're saying there was no protocol by the NDOC on this?
Correct. On the date that we filed the motion to determine the lawfulness of the execution, there was no execution protocol. And one did not appear until after we filed that motion.
Okay, and so that's when you decided to challenge the method, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and so how did you do that? So you said you conjured the court's inherent authority to morph it into what?
Well, that was the basis that we moved the court to make the inquiry. We argued that the court had the prerogative to answer these questions. We invoked statutory authority that I think is pretty clear on this matter. In particular, we asked the court to exercise its authority under NRS 1.210, Prin 3, which talks about how the district court has the inherent authority to determine whether the orders that it issues will be enacted lawfully outside of court. And so that was a specific statutory provision that we invoked, and that the district court, we also invoked, as Justice Pickering mentioned, we also invoked the declaratory relief statute as well. But the basis for the district court's actual decision was that Judge Togliatti had the inherent authority to decide this issue because she was the judge being asked to sign the execution warrant.
Right. Once the protocol was determined, why did it go any further than that? That's what you were asking for.
Because we had serious concerns when the protocol was provided to us.
Okay, why then didn't you file a 1983 action if you were going to challenge the method?
At this point in time, we were operating with a 60-day out time frame for an execution with no stay of execution. At that point in time, the Attorney General had agreed that our motion could be construed as a 1983 action. And the McConnell decision is pretty...
Glossed over that point, though. Didn't the district attorney object, though?
The district attorney originally invoked the McConnell decision, and the second thing that he did is he said, I'm the wrong party, so I'm out. So I'm not going to be responding to any of your motions. So he did raise the McConnell issue. But the long and the short of the matter is that this is not a claim in a habeas petition. This is not a claim under Chapter 34. This is, as the court said in McConnell, claims in a petition entitle a person to relief from their conviction or sentence. We were not talking about a habeas
petition. Indicated there was no stay or anything else. At the time, were you entitled to any stay?
Well, I think arguably we could have been, Your Honor.
Then why didn't you pursue that and file a 1983?
My client would not authorize the stay of execution.
So the conflict issue I just brought up earlier, don't you have an inherent conflict here?
In what way?
in the way that it seems you're looking to the future to set a protocol for future clients, but this client specifically doesn't want this method challenged, from what I understand.
I disagree with that characterization.
Tell me why.
Because one of the things that Mr. Dozier was clear about at the very outset of this litigation was that his first priority was his own execution, and his second priority was to find out about the facts, and if he had the preference, he would prefer a humane execution. That has been a consistent position by Mr. Dozier. He would prefer to have it be less painful rather than more painful. So there was never any tension. I don't see that as any conflict.
Isn't the record contrary to that? He wanted a little bit of exploration, it seems like, but he was steadfast in the fact he didn't want this execution to stall.
I agree with Your Honor as to what you said, that the second part of what you said. He didn't want the execution to stall. And you know what? If it was up to us, he would have been executed on November 14th, 2017. So we didn't do anything that was ever inconsistent with his wishes on that point. We were not authorized to seek a stay of execution. But given the choice, his choice would be to have a humane execution as opposed to a painful, miserable experience.
So do you have a cite for that?
Yeah.
Because you keep saying he said he wants it to be humane, or basically he doesn't want to do it, is what I'm inferring from what you said. Or actually, it's what you said at the outset. Do you have a citation for that to the record?
The citations that I'm thinking about are when he was present in court when I was making representations to the district court. And so I believe that we're talking about the record. I believe the hearing starting on July 27th, when that specific argument was made to Judge Togliatti, he was present in court. And he was canvassed during these proceedings. He was present in court during these proceedings where we made the argument that if given the opportunity, he would prefer a humane execution to a rough and miserable one. And so,
Counsel, let's come back to that particular point, because you keep using the word humane, and you also threw out, this counsel for the other side pointed to a necessary risk versus, under the federal Constitution, substantial risk. And are you making that distinction based on our Constitution having the or involved, or what are you doing in terms of getting there when the constitutional law that's been accepted is substantial risk as to and, but if we're operating in an or, is that why you're making it? Or?
The district court's decision was based upon the and, based upon the federal Constitution. We have asked the court to affirm, or not to affirm, but to deny the writ on alternative grounds that the state constitution necessarily provides greater protection than the federal constitution. And we base that based upon the disjunctive language of the state constitutional provision. The attorney general,
so from your standpoint, this is a matter of first impression?
I believe it is a matter of first impression.
And since it is a matter of first impression, then why was this not brought as a 1983 so it could have been fully vetted?
There was no time. We had no stay of execution. We had no time. We had to do this the way that it unfolded. As the litigation...
Since you have invoked inherent authority in the district court, couldn't you have asked the district court to intervene during the pendency of the litigation?
I guess I'm not seeing the distinction between what the court is maybe suggesting versus what we...
Very simply, why did you not follow the procedure of the court? You use this other extraordinary procedure. Why couldn't you ask the district court to use another extraordinary procedure?
I'm not sure what other extraordinary procedure.
Asking for a stay. If they're entertaining this action, is it not within their inherent authority, the way you're expanding this, to grant a stay?
I represent every client in the best way that I can. If this was a situation where there was an involuntary execution, I would have accompanied my original pleadings with a request for stay of execution. I was not able to do that in this case. The only thing that I was able to be authorized to do was to find out the details about the protocol and to be able to seek as much of a humane execution as we could.
And so you're saying your client didn't authorize you to do that, but in a roundabout way, that's exactly what you're doing.
No, I don't believe so at all. Again, I return to the point where
We were prepared for the execution to occur on November 14th. We hadn't delayed anything. We were consistent with Mr. Dozier's wishes. The reason that we're actually here is because the Nevada Attorney General's office convinced the district court to enter an open-ended stay, and that's what caused us to be here. If it was up to us, we wouldn't actually be here.
So is that on the original? What happens? What happens if you prevail in this case? What happens to Mr. Dozier?
What happens is that there is an injunction that exists on the use of a paralytic agent, which is completely unnecessary in the execution protocol. And so what would happen would be that that injunction order would remain in effect, and the Attorney General would not be allowed to use a paralytic agent when they're also proceeding with this particular protocol.
So they could use the first two drugs, though?
Correct. And there was uncontradicted medical testimony in the record on this point that said that those amounts would be sufficient to cause death, that it wouldn't be cruel and it wouldn't be a substantial risk, that there wouldn't be a risk of air hunger or conscious suffocation. The only risk, the only unnecessary substantial risk here is if a paralytic agent was used in the execution.
But I have a problem. You're in our court making an argument ostensibly on behalf of a client, and what I understand is that the client does not authorize your opposition to the three-drug protocol being utilized.
I mean,
you're here in our court making an argument for a client that doesn't want that argument made on their behalf.
The last thing that Mr. Dozier said, and I think, Justice Pickering, this follows up on your question earlier, is that his current position is that he supports this appeal. And the reference to Pinsight is his letter he submitted to the district court at 1556 to 1557. So, as we sit here today, Mr. Dozier is supportive of this appeal. In fact,
opposition to these writs, to be precise.
He is on board and supportive of our opposition to these writs. And not only that, he has asked me to file a motion for expeditious consideration with the court. And as soon as I get back to the office today, I'm going to do that too, because we're on the same page right now as to the pursuing this appeal. I guess what I would like to do, if there's no more questions on this particular point, is I'd like to talk about the court's actual injunction order. One of the things that has been unclear throughout this litigation is why exactly does the Attorney General insist on using a paralytic drug in this execution? When we look at the justifications that the state has proffered, they have shifted from the trial court to the arguments that they're making in this court. When they originally disclosed the protocol on September 5th, the former chief medical officer intended for the paralytic drug to be the agent of death because he had a very light...
Let me stop you right there. In the protocol that's been established in terms of looking at these issues, it's not so much what the state's going to do. The question is, why is the protocol that you're putting forth, in essence, better, or as you put, more humane than what they have proposed, if we consider that the drugs were available?
Because it doesn't carry any of the risks that their protocol entails. Their protocol has no upside and unlimited downside.
But the question is about what you're advancing, and is there a protocol for that? Because I thought I heard them saying that there was not any information.
This is our alternative as a protocol by subtraction. The only difference between us and them is that they're not allowed to use the paralytic agent at the end because it's totally inappropriate to use in these types of circumstances, particularly when, the case law that we're referring to requires that if you use something like a paralytic drug, there has to be a legitimate justification for its use. There was no evidence proffered.
And what is your evidence that's been proffered as to the procedure that you're putting forth? My question is very simple. So would you walk us through why what you're proposing is superior and should be done? And by doing that, it falls under the risk category that you're attempting to put it under.
In the record below, we had the testimony from Dr. Wiesel, who's an expert anesthesiologist, and he opined specifically comparing the amended protocol proffered by the state from the protocol or the alternative that we proffered. What he testified about was that if we just used a protocol consisting of diazepam and fentanyl, it would be sufficient to cause death, it would not cause a substantial risk of pain, and it wouldn't be accompanied by any of the concerns that he identified regarding the real likelihood that Mr. Dozier could be conscious yet suffocating because he's received a paralytic drug. A paralytic drug kills because it paralyzes the diaphragm so you can't breathe. So based upon that substantial risk, Dr. Wiesel opined that the alternative, which would simply be removing the paralytic, would completely remove that risk and wouldn't carry any risks of its own. So there...
As to the first prong under Bayes, you've shown that the method creates a substantial risk of serious harm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that the proof for that is all you need to do is look at the rationale for the former chief medical officer. He says that there's one circumstance where they need the drug, and it's because Mr. Dozier may try to move his diaphragm to breathe during the course of the procedure. Dr. Wiesel testified that if that happens, that means that you're talking about someone who's moving towards awareness. So if the paralytic is used in circumstances that they describe by their own expert, it's going to result in a torturous execution. So,
and is that substantially likely to occur? Other than speculative?
That Dr. Wiesel testified that that was a substantial risk and that it rose beyond simply the level of mistake or accident. If you look at the Bayes case, it talks about how mistakes or accidents are characterized as things that aren't foreseeable. But here we have an actual prison official who says, this is the reason we need this drug. So if we take him at his own logical conclusion, if he says he needs it, that's also the reason why they can't use it. So if he says we need it for this to address this circumstance, that's the very same circumstance that violates the state and federal constitution, which is that if he's moving his diaphragm muscle to breathe, then that means that he's heading back towards awareness. That's the situation where the district court concluded, based upon Dr. Wiesel's testimony, that you can't use a paralytic drug in those circumstances because the person could be moving towards awareness. Being awake and conscious and suffocating is a hellish experience. That's what Dr. Wiesel testified about based upon his anesthesiology experience. Anesthesiologists strive when we're doing surgical procedures to make sure that we're not awake or aware, because it's a terrifying experience to be awake and aware and not be able to move and to be paralyzed.
So I'm sorry. Wouldn't the protocol that they've developed identify whether he's awake and aware? And that's why we have these check-ins, these pinches, if you will, to determine whether or not he's awake and aware. So your position would be after you get all the way through the diazepam, the fentanyl, and he's not responded to that point, there's still a substantial risk at that point, despite all the check-ins, that he's still awake and aware? A substantial risk of that?
Yes, there is. I mean, on the one hand, there's the issue about whether this is gratuitous and necessary at all, because at this point he's already stopped breathing, and so it's not necessary. If it is necessary, then there is a substantial risk based solely on the justification proffered by the former chief medical officer, that if he says that it's the only reason he wants the paralytic, they can't even tell you right now what they really intend to do with the paralytic drug. Their arguments on this point have been evolving. So yes, in response to the court's question, there was uncontradicted medical testimony from Dr. Wiesel. The findings that the district court made were based on substantial evidence. In the posture of an extraordinary writ, we defer to the factual findings that were made by the district court. There was no contrary testimony. There was no live witnesses to controvert that. And just to clarify one thing, the attorney general said they were not given an opportunity to call their chief medical officer. That's wrong. The district court specifically invited them to do so after the evidentiary hearing, and the reference is volume 4 of the appendix, page 940.
Were they correct on 2 days' notice for the hearing, though?
I got an anesthesiologist out here from Boston
in 2 days. The question was, were they correct about the 2-day notice as to the hearing?
I'm sorry. Can you ask that one more time, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
I'm not going to ask it again. Your answer is fine.
Counsel, let me interrupt you just a second. I want to go right back to the heart of your very answer to Justice Stiglitz's question when you're looking under Bays and Glossop. And you say a substantial risk. Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor.
What's the actual language in Bays? And I don't believe it's substantial risk. I think it's a protocol or a method that is sure or very likely to cause serious suffering. Is that not the standard?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay, how do you get substantial? And where in this record do you see that those facts to support that test under prong one? We'll get to prong two in a second.
Bates and Glossop both say the same language that the court is referring to. If you go to the very next sentence, they say, the way you prove this in your circumstances is by showing that there's a substantial risk of harm that's objectively intolerable.
But this is globally. You can't look at it. The risk here, the substantial risk you're saying is going to occur if the protocol fails with the first two drugs, correct?
That's one.
If there's a mistake in administration, or if they, for some reason, after all these fail-safes, they fail.
That's one reason that it could cause substantial harm is if there's a mistake.
Okay, so in the protocol as a whole, how can you say the protocol, the method, sure or very likely to cause suffering?
Again, I would refer the court.
You would have to have a default position that while the first two drugs are likely to be misadministered or fail.
That's certainly one way that there could be a substantial risk of harm. But the other thing is that what we're talking about, and what I've been trying to talk about, is we're talking about more than a mistake, because we're not talking about something that's unforeseeable. In fact, we actually have a prison official who says, this is the very reason why we need to use it here, is because of the circumstance where it can be used. I want to talk about the language that the court's referring to in Bays and Glossop, because when it says the very imminent, where it has that language, the very next sentence says, the way you show that is by showing a substantial risk of harm that's objectively intolerable. So when you're applying the imminent standard, the very next sentence is, this is how you prove it. And the case that they invoke is a case called Farmer v. Brennan. That's a case from 1994 where the U.S. Supreme Court was addressing the claims that were brought by a transsexual inmate who was in the prison who argued that she shouldn't be put in the general population. And the United States Supreme Court reversed the grant of summary judgment in favor of the prison officials because what they said was, you were put on notice as a prison official that these things could happen.
Let me just stop you right there. In any execution, can't something happen?
Absolutely.
Okay, why is this any different?
Because this goes beyond just a mere risk of harm. One thing that Judge Togliatti differentiated.
What likelihood that this is going to occur? You haven't given us anything.
Well, it's a substantial risk of harm.
Tell me why.
The reason is because it is foreseeable.
But is it likely?
The way that you prove that something is likely under Eighth Amendment law is to show whether there's a substantial risk that's objectively intolerable. That's the very next
sentence. You're saying it's likely because it might happen.
That's exactly the way that the Bays case interprets this type of an issue. And that's why they refer to the Farmer case, which I just talked about, which talks about how in Farmer, you didn't actually have to have actual knowledge that a person was going to be assaulted.
No, and you're never going to have that.
Right. You just have to have a substantial risk. You just have to have it be foreseeable.
Well, let me get to the bottom line. I appreciate everybody's questions. If we approve the 3-drug protocol, is he going to withdraw his request to die?
If
we get rid of the injunction and you have to go back to your client and say they're going to use the paralytic, is he going to withdraw his request to die?
As far as I know right now, Your Honor, no. The answer is no, that he's not going to withdraw his request to die.
So he's
going
to die whether we approve a three-drug protocol or a two-drug protocol?
Yes. Yes.
So that's the bottom line. We just have to decide whether we should reverse as far as the injunction is concerned and grant the petition, or go along with Judge Tagliati and say to the Department of Corrections, you got to use a two-drug protocol if you're going to kill this guy.
Go ahead and answer Justice Cherry's question. Then
Please answer me. I think I asked the question. You turned your head. Then.
I'm sorry. I thought there was going to be an interjection. So
I didn't want to interrupt Justice Cherry. Go ahead.
My understanding as I sit here right now is that regardless of how the court rules, that as far as I know, Mr. Dozier's wishes are to proceed with an execution. So, again, I want to make sure that I answer all parts of the question. I think I kind of got distracted. Was there a second part?
I don't want to be played. I don't want to be played in this by Mr. Dozier or by the Attorney General or by the District Attorney. I don't want to be played. I want to know exactly what's going to happen if we rule in favor of the AG and the District Attorney or we rule in favor of the Federal Public Defender. I want to know what's going to happen to Mr. Dozier. If he's going to die, I understand.
If we rule in favor of Mr. Dozier, then he'll be executed without a paralytic drug. If you rule in favor of the Attorney General, then he'll be executed with a paralytic drug.
Thank you for giving me the bottom line in this litigation.
Justice Hardiston, one significant qualification. The first drug, which is not an issue by either party, has expired. So in the absence of it being a replacement being found, he isn't going to die at all.
Right?
Correct?
Your Honor, I'm at a loss here. Assuming that what they say in their pleadings is true, then the answer to your question is yes. Now, the problem is that this is an issue that's been raised for the first time on appeal, and it's only in their pleadings. They didn't even make these representations in a sworn declaration. So I'm at a loss, Your Honor. I don't know what they have.
Well, counsel has stood before this court and made a representation to this court about this fact. Is there any reason we should disregard what he's represented to the highest court of the state put his integrity on the line when he represented it?
I have no reason at this point, Your Honor, to disagree with counsel's representation.
So to the point that Justice Cherry just made, in the absence of finding a replacement for the first drug, he's not going to be executed.
Yes. Following your logic, Your Honor, the answer.
Well, I think those questions are more relevant to the people who are going to procure a substitute drug rather than you, because I've been a public defender, and I couldn't answer that question. I mean, you don't know what drug they can procure from who, whether they go to another state or they go to another country.
At the district court level, they chose not to disclose any information about the expiration dates of the drugs. They only invoked this as an emergency situation for the first time on appeal. I'm only going off of what they're saying. Again, Your Honor, I have no reason to disagree the representations made by counsel here at home.
Sure.
So, the one thing that I would like to add is that there's been a lot of questions about the alternative without the use of the paralytic. One of the things that I think needs to be clarified here is that the Attorney General's office has basically adopted our alternative already, but just decided to keep the paralytic. We're not saying that they should do anything different than just taking off the paralytic drug. Otherwise, the amended protocol is fine as it stands. And so we're not asking them to do something or to take any measure that they haven't already done anyway. And so I think it's important that that be noted. All you have to do to show that they've adopted the alternative is to compare the September 5th protocol against the protocol that they adopted as soon as they received the report from our expert, Dr. Wiesel. Similarly, our sister state of Arizona is a very active death penalty jurisdiction. And the state of Arizona just stipulated through its Attorney General's office that they will never, ever, ever use a paralytic drug in an execution again. And also that they will never, ever use a benzodiazepine. So Arizona would rather not do executions than use the execution protocol that the state of Nevada proposes to use on Mr.
Do they use it the same way the protocol calls for it in Nevada, as that being the very last fail-safe drug administered? The paralytic?
The procedure in the Guardian litigation was a little bit unclear on that point. The point was is that they were being forced to justify the use.
That makes a big difference.
It does make a very big difference.
Okay, so to make that statement and not link it up kind of makes a big difference.
Well, what they were asked to do in the Guardian litigation was to simply justify the use of a paralytic drug. Now, at the time, they didn't have a specific protocol where it was being used with the paralytic drug, so I have to be candid and say that I don't know the other parts. But I do agree with what Your Honor says about how every execution protocol rises and falls on its own facts. And that's particularly why Judge Togliatti's findings of fact and conclusions of law should receive deference from this court, particularly in the procedural posture of an extraordinary writ where the standard is an arbitrary or capricious abuse of discretion. The Attorney General has never argued that that standard was met. And in fact, when this issue was raised in the district court, the DA argued that any writ filed by the Attorney General before this court would be meritless. And we agree on that point. And their writ doesn't satisfy the standards that are necessary to show that there was a manifest abuse of discretion. Judge Togliatti was being asked to approve a novel and unproven drug protocol that has never been used before anywhere else in the country for the first execution in Nevada in 12 years in an execution chamber that has never been used. And the question is, did she have the inherent authority to ask questions and to make these inquiries? She was the one that would be getting the phone call on the night of the execution if something went sideways. So I think that when the district attorney says, well, this is ministerial, I disagree. I think that signing an execution warrant as a judge is a very serious matter. And I think that any district court in our state being tasked with that awesome responsibility has the right to ask these questions. And so I don't think that
Can the court do that sua sponte, then, is what you're saying, without any prompting by any other party before the court signs a warrant of execution, sua sponte, so I don't want to sign it. I want more on this?
Yes. Well, I think that they can make the inquiries in connection with the issue about, you know, signing the execution warrant. I think that they have the right to ask the questions, and they have the right to pursue the issue, even if it's sua sponte.
So that's, you're saying that's why it's not ministerial?
That's why it's not ministerial. I think this is an awesome responsibility that we put on our district court judges in these circumstances.
What's in the record if the two-drug protocol doesn't work? Let's say he's still alive after the two-drug protocol. What happens then?
If the two-drug protocol doesn't work, then that means that there was a mistake. That what that would mean is that the execution team would titrate the medication to effect, which means that they would go, because they're going to do it through two IV sites. So if the one site doesn't take, they would know there was a mistake, and they would know to switch over to the other site. So assuming the court's question that they give the drugs and he doesn't die, that means that there was a mistake. But if that's the situation that occurs, you can't use a paralytic drug, because a paralytic drug would mask the signs of distress that Mr. Dozier's feeling, and he wouldn't be able to communicate to the execution team that he's in distress and that they need to go through the other arm. So that's precisely why the alternative is a better proposal than going with the amended protocol, because if there's a mistake, it can be addressed. Dr. Wiesel testified that in medicine, a doctor would never take an unnecessary risk. A doctor would treat symptoms. A doctor would not mask symptoms. Judge Togliatti found in her findings of fact that the use of a paralytic drug would constitute a masking event because it would prevent him from showing that he's in distress and that it would also cause conscious suffocation. So in the scenario, Justice Cherry, that you're mentioning, that would be a scenario where if you gave a paralytic drug, it would be torture, something that's been known in the veterinarian community since the 19th century.
Thank you.
I want to address some of the arguments made by the Attorney General. The Attorney General argues that the mere possibility of
this. Can I pause you for just a moment? The statute, I think, that the DA is relying on that signing the execution warrant is ministerial is 176.495, saying that if for any reason a judgment of death has not been executed and it remains in force, the court in which the conviction was had must, upon the application of the AG or the district attorney, cause another warrant to be drawn, and that it has to state the date and the week and so forth. I'm not sure he doesn't have a fair point that that is a ministerial act. I appreciate your point as well, but where in the statutes on the warrant of execution do you find discretion?
I never argued necessarily that this was an issue of discretion. That wasn't the point, I guess. I wasn't saying that there was a statute that said this was a matter of...
But then under Halverson, how do we get to exercising inherent authority to interrogate the warrant of execution that the court is statutorily obligated to sign if everything else has been exhausted?
We've argued that the court had the inherent authority to make that inquiry, even if, as the statute reads, as Your Honor said, even if it's characterized as a ministerial act, that the district court still has the inherent authority. And the statute that we cited for that proposition was NRS
1.2303, but I don't see that either. That doesn't fit this.
It says that a court can enforce its lawful judgments in a proceeding that occurs out of court when there's a proceeding that's occurring in court. And the argument that we've made throughout these proceedings is that a judge is being asked in court to sign an execution warrant that's going to lead to things happening outside of court, and that in those circumstances, the judge has the inherent authority to determine whether the orders that the judge is issuing will be lawful. And I believe that the Attorney General agrees with us on that basis.
And the lawfulness is the constitutional infirmity that you identify,
yes,
which
sir.
Then we come full circle to McConnell in 1983. But
yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No. One thing that I want to be clear about is that the state's saying that we are arguing that we should eliminate all possibility of mistake. The district court was very clear in its order that we're not talking about eliminating all possibility of a mistake. We know that that mistakes can happen. But the question is, are the mistakes we're talking about foreseeable? And if they're foreseeable mistakes, then that brings it, then there's a little bit more culpability on the part of prison officials that doesn't allow them just to say, well, you know, this is just a matter of bungling, or this is just a matter of an isolated mishap. The authorities that we've cited talk about how there is more that's occurring when there's foreseeability. And even if the situation is such that the paralytic is not necessary because Mr. Dozier is already dead or dying at the time, that also implicates whether or not the use of this penalty would be gratuitous. We cited the Hope case in our briefing talking about Alabama's use of a hitching post in the prison system. And they said, you know what, once you've restrained a prisoner, you can't have him on a hitching post like a horse. That's a similar situation that we're talking about here. The paralytic is either gratuitous because it's unnecessary, or it's necessary and it can't be used because it would result in conscious suffocation, because that's the exact scenario where the chief medical officer says that it's needed. So the only reason it's needed is also the only reason that it can't be used.
So didn't Dr. Muro also say it would hasten death?
Yes, he did.
And why is that problematic?
There was uncontradicted testimony from Dr. Wiesel that was not correct.
Well, it's not uncontradicted because Dr. DeMuro said it would hasten death, and Dr. Wiesel said, nuh-uh. So it's not that it's uncontradicted. You have two different opinions about the use of that.
We do, and that's where the trial court's role in our system of justice comes into play in particular fashion, which is that the trial court was able to observe the demeanor of Dr. Wiesel.
Would it hasten death?
The answer is no, and the reason it won't is because if the fentanyl is administered correctly, then his breathing has already stopped. So what Dr. Wiesel explained was that if you administer the fentanyl, the breathing stops. Once the breathing stops, it stops.
Fentanyl takes time. If you're using fentanyl, it's still alive but dying, will the paralytic hasten death?
Dr. Wiesel testified that it would not. The district court found that Dr. Wiesel was very credible. sustain the findings that he made that it would not lead to death. So in other protocols, that could theoretically be true. But in this protocol, it's not. I guess one thing that I would like to say, because I don't have too much time left, is that the state argues that any difference in the state constitution versus the federal constitution should result in less constitutional protection, and that this court should discard notions of evolving standards of decency. We would ask that the court not do that. The Eighth Amendment in Article 1, Section 6 encompass our notions of how we operate as a society. And so when we talk about Mr. Dozier and what he wants, there's also larger issues at stake here, which is how are we going to execute people in the state of Nevada in our name? And if it's not humane for us, shouldn't it be the province of our courts to say whether something is cruel or not? I think that the court has that inherent authority, and I think that the petition should be denied on that ground, that we should have humane executions in the state.
Thank you. Petitioners have, in fact, used up their time. I will give you 3 minutes, though, counsel.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I have a few points I'd like to make, so I'll be brief. Justice Douglas, your point is exactly right. Petitioners had a heavy burden under Bayes to demonstrate that their alternative was better or more humane. And when Dr. Wiesel was asked that question, he was asked, if the first two drugs are delivered as written, is removing the paralytic more than a slight or marginally better alternative? And he said no. That's at 900 of the record. When he was asked by his own attorneys, would the two-drug alternative we're contemplating reduce a risk, his response was candidly, how much of a less of a risk, I can't say. That does not meet his heavy burden under Bayes or this court's decisions in Gijon. Justice Stiglitz, to your point about sure, very likely, or imminent, you'll notice the district court's order doesn't make any finding about this, about the risk that she was concerned about being sure, very likely, or imminent. She couldn't make that finding because of what the Supreme Court said in Bayes and what this court said in Gijon. And Your Honor is also correct about the importance of the consciousness check, and this goes to what Justice Cherry and I were discussing earlier. The consciousness check is the final safeguard to make sure that Mr. Dozier is unconscious before the paralytic is introduced. There would have to be a confluence of unlikely events, mistakes on top of mistakes, for the parade of horribles that Dr. Wiesel is talking about to actually occur. The protocol on its face is constitutionally sound. Under Nooner versus Norris, negligence in carrying out a protocol is not sufficient. This idea of a foreseeable mistake sounds like the equivalent to me of an intentional mistake. I don't know what that means. If there's something that's that foreseeable, that would seem to be a design defect in the protocol itself, not in the realm of a mistake. And so I think those are two completely different things.
Mr. Smith, if this matter had been brought under 1983, what would this court's standard of review be? And does this court owe deference to the trial court with respect to the findings, as Mr. Anthony suggests?
If the case had been brought in a more traditional 1983 action, the standard of review would be the same. The question before this court is the meaning of cruel and unusual punishment in the state and federal constitutions. That is a legal question reviewed de novo, whether it's in this context or 1983 context. Your Honor, the second part of your question?
So does this court owe deference to the trial court's findings with respect to Dr. Wiesel's opinions?
Just like in any other case, if the district court's findings are supported by substantial evidence, then yes. But here there are a number of factual findings that are clearly erroneous. I would point to the evidence the district court said there was no evidence presented on the dignity prong. That's clearly erroneous. There was evidence by Dr. Wiesel that involuntary movements happen under anesthesia and paralytics prevent that. That's a clearly erroneous finding of fact. It's clearly erroneous. This is a legal matter, but to say that the chance of an error alone is enough to create a substantial risk.
Mr. Smith, before you sit down, I have a simple question. Mr. Anthony indicated that the state had adopted or accepted their protocol. Is that true or not, the two-drug protocol?
No, that's absolutely not true. If you look at the defense team's protocol, because remember, no competent admissible evidence from an expert actually supported the protocol.
Dr. Wiesel said in his declaration and on the witness stand, he was specifically refusing to offer an alternative because of supposed ethical reasons. I'm aware of no case that accepts a lawyer's argument on a crucial element of a claim, certainly not in the method of execution context. We cite cases, Brooks, for example, the Schofield decision out of Tennessee, the Terrell concurrence. But if you look at the defense team's alternative offered in a short paragraph in a reply brief, their alternative was take out the paralytic. Department of Corrections is not. Use all the fentanyl and all the diazepam you have on hand. The Department of Corrections is not. Use a BIS monitor to check consciousness. The Department of Corrections is not. There's not one thing that their alternative offered that the state actually adopted.
I will stop you right there.
Thank you, Robert. I appreciate your time.
Counsel, we thank you for the argument. We thank you for all the information. It is a very important subject. As was stated, death is different. This matter stands submitted.